they're not given a COVID-19 test, so we're going to call those test negatives as well. And then, and this is where the presumed positives come in. This is where Dr. Ely was referencing earlier that the test is assumed to, regardless of the test result, if they're not tested, you can go ahead and assume any respiratory illness is COVID-19 with the financial perverse incentive. That is going to turn out to be something where it's complex, because in fact, it could be a true positive. Because they weren't tested, we don't know, the virus could be present. So we're going to put that back to this category where the virus is present, and it can either become a true positive or still two categories of false positives. Here we have the presumed coronavirus fatality, but the virus was actually absent, and that's going to be a false positive. And that also plays into enhancing these false positive rates, because these are, again, are just the clinical, the technical false positives of the test. Now, if you have a negative test, either because you weren't tested or the test turned back negative, if you don't presume, if you overrule the prescription, the mandate to presume all deaths due to COVID-19, if otherwise specified, if you have another reason, like Dr. Scott Jensen estimates 25% of his cases that he's looked at who, that died should not be considered COVID-19 at all, then the virus could still be present. You could be wrong. And then it then becomes the question whether or not it was a causal factor or not. And then the other category is the virus is present, but it was unrelated anyway. And then, of course, if it's not presumed and the virus is truly absent, we have the true negatives. What I've done here is fleshed out the entire tree of possible combinations, and you can see there's the true positive. There's one route to two positives here, a circuitous route through the presumption pathway. There's, I count four different categories of false positives, a false negative, and then two categories of true negative. What this represents is an irreconcilable number of ways to get this wrong with CDC's algorithm. CDC's algorithm should absolutely have invited public comment, so people like me and the hundreds or thousands of other people around the country that are involved in clinical diagnostics, have developed clinical diagnostics and biomarkers, could point this very scenario out to the CDC way back in March and ask them, what are you thinking? This is madness. Look at what's going to happen to you. You have to make sure that you have zero false positives, and you can't just claim that you have zero false positives because the prevalence is low. This is the reference I wanted to say about we need to basically replace the CDC. Plan B, public health infrastructure and operations oversight reform for America. The CDC is not in any way, we heard it tonight, interested in any other cause of morbidity or mortality in the United States other than pathogenic illness that they might be able to prevent the diagnosis of with a vaccine. This is a massive, massive mistake on the part of the United States of America. So I'm asking, my ask is that every American citizen contact their congressman and their senator and say, that take a look at this, send them this paper. It's freely available online, it's peer reviewed. Send it to your representatives and say, we really need to find out what the major causes of morbidity and mortality are in the United States, and how do we reform the way we conduct ourselves in the United States of America that take all of those concerns into play. I'm not going to go into details, but basically what we end up with is a neural network arrangement of entities scattered across the country that can't do anything but learn. But the most important point here is that at the end, this is depoliticized. It is distributed all across the country in a way that is decentralized. And the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States, who's President pro tempore of the House, is informed on what the policies are. So it can never become public health, your wellness, your medical wellness can never again become a political commodity. It is already a financial commodity, but look into Plan B. That's an absolute essential reform in the United States. And our goal to help out here, Dr. Ely's on it now. We were not collaborating before the publication. We are now on a committee that is overseeing this particular nucleic acid technology evaluation consortium. We're going to outfit Dr. Singhang Li with a workflow, access to clinical resources throughout New England, access to the resources he needs to actually sequence more of the clinical samples. There's not enough sequencing done in the United States, and everyone knows it. To do sequencing by his method, which he assures us will actually tell us what's present in the sample and not just tell us it's COVID-19 or not. It will also tell us, based on my prompting, to include primers for other pathogens so we can see if it's influenza A, B, oh, and others as well. Dolores Cahill also prompted this. There are many people on the consortium. It's at the IPAC website. Our initial goal is $133,000 to just fund Dr. Li. The overall consortium is, the goal is $300,000, so we can outfit him with a next generation sequencer so we can do the whole genome sequencing of pathogens as well. And so you can find the Nucleic Acid Testing Evaluation Consortium at the IPAC website. This is the pictures of the people who've joined on the consortium. We're a pretty close-knit group. I'm all business about science. Hope to make these things a reality, and we need your help.
Wow, Dr. Jack, thank you, and I commend you for diving so deeply into the most granular of levels with the data disaster we're revealing today, as well as providing a solution now. So that's what's so encouraging about your work, and of course, this event is, we're going to empower you listeners with a way to contact your elected officials and disseminate this information very easily. So stay with us. The call to action is coming soon. So Dr. Ely, you've done a lot of work in helping people understand this asymptomatic transmission, right? And in your upcoming paper, I think it's going to be also highlighted. What we'd love to hear from you is a little bit more about that concept, as well as safe and effective treatments that are available, but they're getting almost no mainstream coverage.
Well, Sayer, thank you so much for that. And what I want to say first and foremost is I'm very passionate, and I'm also very optimistic. And I believe that there are good people in these institutions. I believe that there are good people at the county level, at the state level. I've been very fortunate to talk with the head epidemiologist on an expert forum last week about nutrition. And he agreed with me that nutrition, that people who get the nutrition we're about to talk about have much better outcomes, and that we have to do a better job of getting that information to the people. And so I'm openly pressing to collaborate with him. And our intention is always to collaborate with the good people who don't have an agenda, don't have a financial motive, or a conflict of interest, and so forth. So to that end, I really commend what Dr. Martin is saying, because it's so passionate, and what Dr. Jack is saying, because it's so just passionate. And I think what Dr. Jack just said, that as a doctor, it makes me go, this is exactly why we do, say, our confirmatory lab testing. We don't rely just on one test as the key and only diagnostic. We rely on viral load testing. We rely on antibody testing. We take a sample and we put it in a live cell culture and see if it can infect the cell and therefore prove infectivity in the person. But in medicine, we don't rely on one test ever. We always have confirmatory tests, and that's what helps us get to what's so important, say, or what's called a definitive diagnosis. Now, as it pertains to nutrient deficiencies, the CDC has known via their NHANES studies for over 20 years that 35 to 45% of Americans are deficient in vitamin A, 37 to 46% of Americans are deficient in vitamin C, 65 to 95% of Americans are deficient in vitamin D, 60 to 84% of Americans are deficient in vitamin E, and 11 to 15% of Americans are deficient in zinc. It's not a coincidence that each of these nutrients I just mentioned are key biochemical players in a well-nourished and effective immune system. You need to have these nutrients in order for your immune system to do its job, so that if even one of these is missing, then you run the risk of an immune system that is not able to correctly deal with infections, including SARS-CoV-2. We've culled the research, Sayer. My team has just crushed it on this level, finding hundreds of evidence-based clinical trials specifically for COVID. I'm going to read just a couple of them to your viewers. Vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, and iodine were administered to 107 moderate to severe COVID patients. All of them fully recovered within 7 days of treatment. And this was actually published on Dr. Jack's independent peer-reviewed journal, IPAC. A Chinese hospital in the epicenter in Wuhan took on 50 cases of moderate to severe COVID-19 and used IV vitamin C. And what they found was that not only was there no morbidity, but that the stay in the hospital was on average 3 to 5 days shorter than the people who didn't use intravenous vitamin C therapy. There was no mortality in the IVAA group. There were no side effects from the IVAA group, and there was a successful 100% management of cytokine storms. Huge. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D3 in another study significantly reduced ICU admission rates, as well as reduced the severity of COVID-19 disease. Of the 50 total patients who received vitamin D3, only one was admitted to the ICU. That makes up 2% of their study. Of the 26 patients who were not administered vitamin D3, 13 were admitted to the ICU. Of the 50 patients treated with vitamin D3, zero deaths occurred, and all 50 patients were eventually discharged without complications. Just a couple more. Vitamin D deficiency was associated with increased hospitalizations and increased mortality. Severe cases of COVID-19 were 64% more likely to be vitamin D deficient than mild cases of COVID-19. Their conclusion, Sayer: vitamin D deficiency is associated with higher infection rates, increased instances of sepsis, and increased mortality risk among critically ill populations. Last one for you, Sayer, on the studies. A total of 191,779 patients were included in this study. Median age was 54 years. 60% of the enrolled participants were female. The SARS-CoV-2 positivity rate was higher in the 39,190 patients with deficient levels of vitamin D, that's under 20 nanograms per milliliter, than the 27,870 patients with adequate. And adequate was just considered 30 to 34 nanograms there. From a naturopathic doctor standpoint, that's still deficient. Okay, but when we get to over 50 nanograms per liter of vitamin D when they do a blood sample, only 5.9% of the people who had that high level of vitamin D circulating in their bloodstream even contracted it. Now, here's their conclusion, Sayer. SARS-CoV-2 positivity is strongly and inversely associated with circulating vitamin D in the bloodstream, a relationship that persists across all latitudes, all races, all ethnicities, both sexes, and age ranges. What did I say earlier? This is the SARS-CoV-2 doesn't care what the color of your skin is. Mm-hmm. It cares about your nutrient status. All right. Their final statement on this: our findings provide impetus to explore the role of vitamin D supplementation in reducing the risk of SARS-CoV-2 infection and COVID-19 disease. Now, what I want to say to that, Sayer, is my team has authored now a definitive guideline based upon evidence-based research, real science, into determining what amount our seniors, adults, teens, our school-age kids, and even all the way down to 1 year of age need to have on a daily basis to protect themselves so that we can have a safe return to in-person education, a responsible reopening of small businesses, and a getting back on with our lives. Because I don't know about you, Sarah, but for me, Americans don't let Americans die alone, but that's been happening. Americans don't let American children suffer alone, but that's been happening. Americans, at our core, we are good. We are good people, and what's going on right now is not good. So to that end, Sayer, I'll answer your final question about the asymptomatic transmission and build off of what Ms. Garner had said earlier about the Wuhan study. There was one study done about asymptomatic transmission. This is going to blow your mind if you're watching this at home. It blew my mind. It was published in November in Nature Journal. The Wuhan participant study had 9,898,828 enrolled participants, almost 10 million participants that they tested using the PCR. Only 300 possible asymptomatic carrier candidates were identified. So then they took those 300 and they said, let's get confirmatory lab tested. They're doing what should happen. Of the 300 possible asymptomatic carriers, all were tested using live cell culture to determine if their PCR samples could produce replication competent virus, a phrase you've heard Dr. Fauci say repeatedly. All 300 of those people that they thought were asymptomatic carriers, not one of them could produce a live cell culture, meaning that none of them were infectious. So what that told us was that out of the 9,898,828 people tested in the largest study ever conducted in a single year with enrolled participants, there was a 0.00000% chance of asymptomatic transmission. It has to this day never been proven. Our fifth paper proves that. And all of these studies that you see coming out, funded by the NIH, funded by the CDC, that are published in JAMA, they are nothing more than projection model studies with zero enrolled participants. They are, in essence, scientific fraud. And it's something that is absolutely disgusting and that we have to denounce as a culture so that we can get to the heart of the matter and get on with ending the suffering that our brothers and sisters are going through right now. I cannot abide by the amount of suffering that the people that we love so much are enduring. It's been too long. It's enough. Let's get on with it.
That is so beautiful and so resonant. And I really appreciate that you communicated that to everyone listening. It's super helpful. Superintendent Thielman, given what you've just heard, what's going on through your mind right now, and what are the implications of what you heard for in-person education and athletics for our children?
There's just been a tremendous amount of information, and a lot of it mirrors what we've experienced here being open as a school. The narrative that we've been told didn't, and the data that was being posted didn't relate to the experience we were having in real life. And, I'm a school superintendent, so I kind of give the qualitative side, not so much the quantitative side of this, but I really want to emphasize, and I think it was Dr. Bragan also said this, and Dr. Ely talking about just simple vitamins and nutrients. These are no-brainer things that we ought to be doing. And I just really want to highlight the why. So, Dr. Bragan talked about children need connection and love. Children need to be in school. And I live about 65 miles away from the place I work. And I was talking to a mother after church. She was in tears because her son wanted to drop out of high school. And I said, well, hey, let me talk to your kid and I'll see if he would be interested in coming out to LC, because I'm driving there anyway. And I'll just pick him up in the morning on each school day. So sure enough, I went and marketed and the young man said, yeah, okay, I'm going to come to this little tiny school. And within 6 weeks, he's a new kid and totally bought in every day. He's waiting at 6 o'clock in the morning, never been late, always on the porch, absolutely engaged in school because he had been out of school so long. The long and short of it is sometimes we have late nights because I have late night board meetings once a month. And my daughter also comes to school here. And so it's usually a crowded car. And we got out about 10:30 and my daughter fell asleep and this young man fell asleep. And then we all of a sudden he woke up and he was talkative and he started telling me, and it's hard to talk about because this is the real human side. He started talking to me about how he was planning on ending his, doing harm to himself, attempting on his life. And then this guy showed up and said, hey, come to school. And then he just thought, well, why not? And he said, he talked about how his entire life has changed because he's been able to come to school in person and that he's got a superintendent that picks him up. And of course, I'm listening to this. And what do you say other than listen? And he said, and I cannot wait. I've never played a sport in my life, and everyone wants me to play football. Well, this young man is a very, very big, big kid. And in a small school, he stands out. And he's popular, and he has friends. And I'll tell you, I didn't sleep that night because we have a governor who, up until very, very recently, and only under tremendous amounts of pressure, largely produced by people like myself, said no to sports. And you know, I just finally, you know, threw down with our decision makers. They can have football or funerals. To date, in Oregon, the state of Oregon, kids 0 to 19 years old, we have lost zero kids aged 0 to 19 to COVID. But all of the schools are closed, at least the vast majority. Kids have been isolated, and they're doing harm to themselves. And it's not just the ones that end their lives. It's the ones that cut. It's the ones that are succumb to anxiety and depression, who withdraw, who get engaged in things that aren't okay because they're on the computer all day. These are the qualitative aspects of some of the other things that some of the other speakers have done a better job of quantizing. And that's what I want to leave the audience with. Why should we push forward and investigate this? That's why. We're talking about the next generation of kids that we are failing, and we will continue to fail if we don't bring this out into the light and we don't make a course correction very, very quickly.
Thank you so much for that. So, Dr. Bregan, you're our final panelist for this roundtable. You know, at the risk of asking an obvious question, why is it so important for our children to be back in school immediately and without undue restriction? And what can we expect throughout society if this questionable emergency continues on for much longer?
Well, I'd like to make a few summary remarks since I'm the last person as well, briefly. And I want to start out by thanking Stand for Health Freedom. I mean, this is amazing what you've done, and it's just marvelous. And we haven't seen Leah Wilson here on the film anywhere, so I want to just give her a shout out and say thanks for having me here, along with all these other distinguished guests. I would like to, about our children, we're probably setting them way back. It's a potential catastrophe. We're teaching them to be afraid of each other. We're teaching them to be afraid of the government. We're teaching them that nobody cares enough about them to risk getting COVID-19 to teach them. We're giving them, bringing them up in a paranoid world. We're going to make them more scared. None of this is taken into account by the public health people. Zero. You just don't find any discussions. I haven't in the public health literature. Certainly in the medical literature, I haven't found any. I'm a physician. I haven't found any. So we need to open the schools up. We don't have a medical crisis. We have a politically induced, with the excuse of COVID-19, social crisis and political crisis. One of the things that has not been mentioned enough, I think, is that America is in a state of political crisis. We have been cowed. Our children have been cowed. I was reading an article by a letter by a fellow physician, and she was describing sitting in her office and seeing a line of 5 years old, 4 years old, 3 years old, that would have ordinarily been holding hands. And they had their hands behind their backs, and their heads were bent, and they had masks on their faces, and they weren't relating to anybody. And it brought to her mind and mine images of the gulag. This is what we're preparing our children for. We are preparing them not to be citizens of a robust democratic republic, but to be citizens of global predators, a bizarre kind of global governance that's going on right now outside the hands even of the governments. So that's enough to say about the kids. I want to say that we need all the approaches we can have to looking at this. I'm not concerned about somebody saying I'm giving a conspiracy theory. I'm not interested anymore in people and they're saying that. We need to take overview look at what the heck's going on. And then we need to take the scientific look. I mean, I started out being given this giant task at the, I guess what most people are seeing is my little affidavit, but you know, write this paper for the legal case. And it started out with, oh yeah, the effects on the children. And then I looked at Fauci. We've talked about Fauci. I've been studying Fauci. But Fauci leads to China, directly to China. And we need to be able to listen to that because America is in a war with another country. We haven't declared it. They declared it decades ago. They have a policy of undermining America, getting their scientists into all of our laboratories, into all of our schools. And they are the ones that released, whether accidentally or not, COVID-19. They then spread it around the world with all their might, with the cooperation of all the major medical journals. Nobody called it a feet to the fire. The World Health Organization, nobody's saying, why did you shut down travel in China and send your airplanes out for weeks spreading the virus? So we're looking at something large. It's not really as vague as I may be sounding. It's economic, it's political. And I think we just need to be seriously looking at every level now, because this is, I think America is in as much danger as prior to the Civil War and prior to the Revolutionary War right now. We really need to take it seriously. I'll give you a couple of examples of the stuff that I've been working on, writing about. A study is created in Brazil, where people are given hydroxychloroquine in multiples of the toxic dose for older people and for sick people. It's put up online, and in one day, it's covered in the New York Times as don't take hydroxy, it kills people. And in one more day, it's put up online by the Journal of the American Medical Association. And on from there. Lancet has done the same thing. New England Journal of Medicine has done the same thing. WHO is doing the same thing. All of our major agencies, the CDC, it's acting like it's got medical jurisdiction, telling us how we're supposed to be treated. The FDA has way overstepped its legal bounds. The NIH tells us that we can't treat people with COVID-19. I can't. I'm a doctor. I could treat a person if I wanted to, though I'm a psychiatrist. When one of my family members got sick, I had to put them in charge with the frontline doctors. Again, it's important to know about the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And in one day, she and her partner were well in the middle of a severe beginning of this case of COVID-19, and she had many, many vulnerabilities. She wasn't that young. So, and a lot of it involves things that Dr. Earlier talking about, the physicians, because, you know, we have to give drugs, you know that. And I'm very sympathetic to your viewpoint, because everything you're talking about is pretty much what they're combining with the medications they're using. So who knows what it is? We got to study all this. We need everybody working on these issues from every branch of medicine. So I want to just leave you that we're really looking at something that is so much bigger than COVID-19. We are looking at the death of freedom in science, the death of freedom in our chat rooms and in our Twitter and in our YouTube, all these companies, and all these companies want to continue COVID-19. They'll take anybody down they feel like it who's got a good idea about it, literally. So this thing's being kept up, it's being upheld by a huge number of collaborating, roughly collaborating agents around the world, including the almost every billionaire that I could check out, and all the big companies. So I want to leave you with the overview, and thank you so much for giving us all a voice here. One last message. I'm 84 years old. I'm going on 85. By the way, my mind seems to be gotten a little better. I think because I just keep having a happier and happier marriage for 35 years. So my mind keeps getting better and better under my wife's influence. And with Stand for Health Freedom, we created elders who don't want the schools closed, elders who don't want the restaurants closed. So my message, my final message now, as an elder, and I signed this petition first, and then my wife Ginger signed it. She's 79, I'm 84, going on five, she's 79. And then her mom, who lives with us, signed it. She's 94. And then we have thousands of people. And this is all because of health, Stand for Health Freedom. And I want to say, even if it killed me, I wouldn't want this being done to our children. And that's what we say. And it isn't going to kill me. Not very good. Probably going to be something else. Something else. Actually, we think we had it. We had the loss of taste and smell and the cough and everything way back in January. I have Chinese friends and Chinese community at Cornell. I'm not at Cornell. They'll have a heart attack if they apply that. So we elders want you all to go free, and then we'll take care of ourselves, because we're the only vulnerable people, and we may be hardly vulnerable at all, because as you heard today, the whole medical establishment is a pack of liars right now. Live, live. That's my concluding remark. Live.
That's a great way to conclude, Dr. Breggin. Thank you. Before we close the panel off and also close with final remarks as well as the call to action, Dr. Ely would like to make one last comment here. So feel free. Dr. Ely will be on here in a minute. I want to acknowledge that okay, are you here?
Here. I was talking.
Sorry. I didn't hear it.
No. Yeah, it was my
That's
fault.
As bad as my having my snack of mixed nuts in the middle of the show.
It, Dr. Breggin, we're cut from the same cloth. It was just user error, buddy. So what I wanted to say first and foremost there was thank you so much for doing this. And I wanted to say on behalf of all of the panelists and to all the panelists, thank you for coming up. It shouldn't be an act of bravery to speak truth, but for whatever reason, it is. And Sayer, you, your team have been amazing. I just want to say one final thought out to anybody watching this, and I mean this, and this might come out as a little kitschy or whatever. I don't care, all right? Like what Dr. Breggin just said, we're at a moment where we need some catchy stuff. But I encourage all of my Black brothers and sisters, all of my Anglo warrior mamas and papas, mi hermanos y hermanas, mi kapuna kanes and kapuna wahines, as well as my Asian uncles, Arabic aunties, and Hebrew cousins, to join us in taking action. We can't sit on the sidelines on this one. Please do what Sayer asks you to do after this. Join us in calling for formal investigations into the CDC's conduct. We've all been through so much, and we deserve to know the truth. That's what Dr. Martin is advocating for. That's what Dr. Jack is advocating for. That's what me and my team are advocating for. And I just want to say, It's our time to call in our ancestors and say, in the words of the great First Nations peoples, Aho Itakwe Oyasin, which means for all of our relations. That's our call to action and our call to service. It's not about skin tone. It's not about your culture. It's not about who you voted for. It's not about your religion and where you worship. It's about our children and our humanity. That's what it's about. That's why we're doing this.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, panelists. I just want to acknowledge that every single person that came here tonight to share their experience, knowledge, and what they've already been doing on our behalf is contributing profoundly to humanity. And I have so much respect and admiration for each and every one of you. And I think by showing up in this way, we are inspiring so many of you now who are also taking the time and interest to really learn about the facts of how we ended up in this situation. We have presently experienced around the world the suspension of fundamental civil liberties, basic human rights, economic destruction that has wrought far more damage than any specific virus could be capable of. And so what we're asking people to do is to join us and be part of really taking back control of our destinies on a very basic level. And what we have, thankfully, is the Stand for Health Freedom Advocacy Platform. All you have to do is go down below. If you're watching from Stand for Health Freedom, if you're on YouTube, there'll be a link to this page, and you can go to the Take Action tab, then scroll down to our new CDC campaign. This is a very effective way to send a direct message. Stand for Health Freedom exists so that there are no barriers to entry, so that anyone can contact their elected officials and go ahead and make a clear statement that you stand for everything that we've discussed here today, as far as transparency, as far as affirming informed consent, parental rights, and again, very basic human rights are at stake in this situation. After you click on it, on the tab Take Action, it takes a click of a button to send a pre-drafted, customizable email to key congressmen and women asking for formal hearing an investigation into the CDC's conduct during COVID-19, specifically on the lawfulness of changing death certificates. Once you act on campaign, please share this video and the call to action link with at least three people. This network effect will literally grow this into a movement that will affect change at a very high and significant level. It's all of us coming together, taking action together, and standing together that makes a difference. So once again, thank you so much, panelists. Thank you, everyone that's here. Let's spread this far and wide. Together, we are going to make a beautiful difference in the world. Thanks so much.